Now moving on to our lecture for this evening, we've got Ian Butterworth tonight from NPL. He's going to be talking about a very interesting new technique for visualising the radiation of loudspeakers. So, yeah, looking forward to that. And fill this out if you can, thanks.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. So my name's Ian Butterworth. I work at NPL. NPL haven't had a tremendous amount of involvement with the AES in the past, but we have been working in acoustics for a long time. So I'll give you an idea of who NPL are, if you don't know. So this is the Magna Carta, and in the Magna Carta it talks about standardisation, and standardisation is key to what NPL does. So we are the National Measurement Institute for the UK. So we are in charge of kind of like measurement standards and the standardisation of the SI units and that kind of thing. So we started in 1900. This is one of the old buildings being opened by the Prince of Wales. We invented radar. I think this is in the original patent. So you get an idea of the high-tech stuff. The third ever computer was built at NPL by Alan Turing. It supposedly did something. So in some respects it's the first, and in others it's kind of the third, so quite novel. We've built the world's first cesium atomic clock. And over the years, we've kind of been toing and froing about whether we hold the time standard. It kind of goes around the world to the other national measurement institutes. At the moment, we have the most accurate clock. It's incredibly accurate. Like, it's something like 10 orders of magnitude more accurate than any other SI unit. Packet switching was developed actually to send messages internally at NPL. And obviously, packet switching is kind of key to the internet, so we're one of the people that claim that we invented the internet. So, not sure if that's true. But. Okay, so the acoustics guys were doing stuff as well all the while. There's some motor horns being tested. It's a shame that we don't wear suits nowadays, because I don't think you'll get pictures like this. And here's some of our old facilities. So, on the left is... And it's an anechoic chamber, but it's got a different floor to the wall. So you can imagine that it was not as anechoic as it should be. And then on the right at the top, we have some speaker directivity with some examples of some old style microphones. You'll see the one that looks like a poppy hanging down at the top. So that used to be a standard testing microphone. They've kind of shrunk over the years. And then down on the bottom right, we have our old reverberation chamber. And this is what we have now. So about 10 years ago, the government said we could have a new building, and it caused a lot of problems, but we ended up getting it. And we've got really good temperature, humidity controls, pretty much everything you need for the various different things that NPL does. So just to give you an idea, these are all the departments that we do have. So it spans right across the physical sciences, kind of focusing on measurement and standardisation. And I'm in the top left-hand one, so we'll start up there. No, we won't. Okay, so just a bit more. So I've already said this, but we've got the current most accurate clock, the second. So it looks like this, but they mocked up a version of it that looks like this to make some better pictures. It's pretty accurate, as you can see over there. And at the moment, we're redefining the kilogram. So you may know that the kilogram is the only physical standard left. So we actually have the UK kilogram, which is a block of metal that's kept inside a bell jar in a vacuum, that's completely, entirely uncorrosive. And what they're doing at the moment is they're converting it into a measurement of the number of atoms in a sphere of silicon instead of a physical measurement of mass, because then you're kind of traceable and you can kind of go to so many more decimal places. But that's kind of the big one that's being fought out across the world at the moment, so you may hear about that on the BBC. Okay, so acoustic standards. Acoustics, you know, the decibel isn't directly an SI unit, but we are involved in measurement science and standardisation. So we have new facilities now. That's our reverberation chamber on the left, and on the right is our hemianechoic chamber. They're all temperature controlled, humidity controlled, sitting on springs, and you know, below 0 decibels. And the reverberation time at low frequencies in our reverb chamber is between 30 to 40 seconds. Obviously, at high frequencies, that kind of decays a lot quicker, so you don't get that ringing. But at low frequencies, if you slam the door, you hear it for about 40 seconds. Okay, so this is one of the areas that we're working in, new ear simulators. It's quite well known that ear simulators are, the standardisation of them is quite poor. They don't really reflect the variation of people's ears, because if you look around, everybody pretty much has different ears. So it's quite an interesting thing to try and standardise. So we're working on a new model that takes that into account, and also takes into account things like bone vibration, because increasingly we're starting to get kind of bone conduction headphones and those kind of things, and there isn't really the standards in place, or at least they need modernisation. And MEMS microphones, so we're pushing towards trying to replace testing grade microphones on the right, so this is a blown up image obviously, with MEMS microphones. So the microphone on the right, you may know, will cost you about £1,000 upwards for the microphone and the preamp. And it'll have a very flat frequency response and quite a good phase response. But it will cost you £1,000. On the left, a MEMS microphone, which are increasingly, you know, becoming higher quality with the advent of smartphones and all that kind of stuff, and the amount of money in that industry. We're basically looking at ways to take the low-cost devices like this, which have reasonably good frequency responses. They kind of duck off at about 10 kilohertz. And kind of build adapters and kind of mechanisms so that we can improve them, so we can start using them for sound level meters and that kind of thing. So that would cost you £1 if that, versus £1,000. So one of the projects that we use that technology in is in distributing sound level meters and microphones and looking at building up noise maps. So you may know that noise maps are required by the EU to be made for every town and city of worth, and you know, over a certain size. So we kind of did a project where we were distributing MEMS microphones and kind of tracking the data and turning it into this kind of Google Maps kind of interface, so you can look at the noise levels and kind of get an image of how it's changing. This is an example near City Airport in London. I like this example because it's quite neat, because we happened to be measuring across the time in which the volcanic ash disruption happened, and planes are grounded for a week. So you see your variation here, daily variation, it drops off for a week and comes back. So it just gives you an idea. It's quite a convenient data set there. Okay, so onto the main star, the acousto-optic effect. So the acousto-optic effect has been something that's been known about, you know, for a long time. Schlieren imaging, which you may have heard about, uses this effect. And much in the way if you see a temperature rise, you know, a mirage, density changes in the density of air can change the refractive index of the air, and as a result, light gets bent. Like, the light actually gets slowed down or sped up, depending on the density of the medium, in this case air, and that, in effect, causes a bending. So what you perceive here is a variation in the intensity of the light, just because some of the light is being bent over to a place. So you get kind of, some people call it shadowography. On the right, there's a bullet moving through a medium. I'm not entirely sure what that medium is. It might be water, it might be air, but you see the shockwave coming off the front of it. So Schlieren has been around for a long time. It was first developed in 1906, and it was looking at mirror aberrations. So you can see the kind of setup on the right. So what you have is a collimated light source, and you look through your acoustic field, and you have a light stop. And the idea is that any of the light that's bent because of a change in refractive index will be visible off axis. But the problem with Schlieren in this kind of application is that it has, you have to have collimated light. The light source has to be collimated. And as a result, to get that collimation, you need quite large optics. You kind of need to go, if you want to look through an area this big, you need a lens that big. Otherwise, if you start to go through at different angles, you start to get interference and your kind of the effect becomes kind of vignetted and you get inaccuracies around the outside. Okay, so here's some examples of some tone bursts coming out of an ultrasonic transducer hitting diffraction grating. So there's a single slit on the left and a double slit on the right. Now this is work that was done by Victor Humphreys from the ISVR, and this is pretty much what you'd expect from Schlieren. So this is quite a small area. You have a small viewing window, and the kind of clarity of the detail. There is, you know, some impressive detail, and especially given the fact that it looks pretty much like you'd expect it to look like if you had a Rickle tank, you know, which is always quite impressive. But there are problems with focusing and getting that data kind of towards quantitative data, because it's very qualitative and it's impressive, but it's not so quantitative. So here's another example of a pulse hitting on the left a solid cylinder, on the right a hollow water-filled cylinder. So I guess, I mean, the first time people see this kind of stuff, it is quite impressive that, because the speed in which sound travels and the fact that it is, in most cases, invisible to the naked eye, we don't quite think about kind of the reflective structure that you get in these kind of conditions. And this kind of technique can be used. Obviously, nowadays we have predictive methods. But this still can be used for kind of design and optimization. Okay, so up to the 21st century, and we have we bought a laser vibrometer. They're devices that are designed for scanning of vibrating surfaces. So it uses the Doppler effect. So what you do is say if you have a loudspeaker cone or an ultrasonic transducer or a car or anything, you shine the light onto the object and it looks at the Doppler shift of the light coming back. And I have a video for this.
To measure vibrations. If light is scattered from a moving object, its frequency is changed slightly. Within a Polytech vibrometer, a high-precision interferometer detects the minute frequency shifts of the backscattered laser light. To achieve this, the interferometer splits the light into two parts. The so-called reference beam is pointed directly to the photodetector, while the measurement beam is incident on the test object, where the light is scattered by the moving surface. Depending on the velocity and displacement, the backscattered light is changed in frequency and phase. The characteristics of the motion are completely contained in the backscattered light. The superposition of this light with the reference beam creates a modulated detector output signal, revealing the Doppler shift in frequency. Signal processing and analysis provides the vibrational velocity and displacement of the test object.
Okay, so it's kind of a non-contact measurement device, so it's designed to be used for kind of measuring the vibrations of plates and things like that. So we're not using it how it should be used. We're using it like this. So what we have is I should say it's a Polytech scanning vibrometer, and Joe's here if you want any questions afterwards. So we have the scanning vibrometer on the right. So basically, it can scan in two axes. And you can focus the laser at depth. And we have a fixed retroreflective board on the left. Okay, so this board is stiff and it doesn't vibrate. It does, but the amplitude is very small. And it's covered in a retroreflective material that's very similar to road signs. You can also use the kind of thing that are on safety jackets, kind of quite dense retroreflective material. One of the issues with retroreflective material that road signs are made out of is that road signs need to be seen during the day. So they're actually retroreflective crystals printed onto a white background. So there is gaps in between the retroreflective crystals that isn't retroreflective. So if you hit one of those spots, you don't get much light back. But the problem with the material that you get on safety jackets is that it's quite thin. And you don't want that to be moved by your acoustic field, especially the low frequencies. So what we do is we take the laser point and we scan through the field, outputting a test signal for each measurement point. So if you have a sweep, you scan the top left-hand corner and you say you measure 2,000 samples at 100 kilohertz or 50 kilohertz or something, and you output your sweep from the speaker, and then you move on to the next point and output the sweep again. And it might sound quite arduous, but it can do it very quickly. We adopt averaging as well, and we can run a sweep maybe 30 times a second, so we get 30 averages a second, so a data point per second. So 20,000 data points, that will take a while, but not too long. For higher resolution, high averaging, it's kind of an overnight affair sometimes. So the laser is scanned through the acoustic field, reflected off the retroreflector, and the change in Doppler shift, or the Doppler shift of the light, we assume to be proportional to the acoustic intensity or the pressure at that point, and it's all done very quickly. So one of the things at MPL is that we are designed to kind of support industry. So it's really good if we're kind of working on these techniques to get industry on board, just to make sure that if we're developing something, it's actually going to be usable. Back in the 1940s, you probably didn't have to do that, but nowadays we're kind of being pressured to actually make sure that our techniques and developments are kind of industrially viable. So we paired up with PMC, the speaker manufacturers of studio, professional, and consumer and speakers, just to kind of do some studies of the kind of fields radiating from these speakers. So I'm going to have to come out of here because I didn't want to put too many videos in here because I know PowerPoint has a tendency to like to crash, especially when you've got 2 gig of videos in there. Okay, so I'm going to start high frequency. Okay, so what I have here is, that's not going to loop. It's a single frequency pulled out of an of a sine sweep by the software. So you basically do a sweep and you can look at a single band and you can loop that band to give you an idea of the radiation patterns. So I'm going down in frequency now. So this is at 2.4 kilohertz. So you can see that in this case, the woofer has started to act. So the tweeter is quite clearly in action at the beginning, and the woofer starts to react. And then we start to get some complexities. So in this case, the speaker being scanned is an active crossover monitor speakers. So the drop-off is kind of 24 decibels per octave. So this is actually a very good result. Some of the earlier scans that we did, we saw huge modal breakup because the problem is that passive crossovers have slow drop-offs, and also their phase is kind of not as controllable for active crossovers. So there's some complexity here, and you're starting to see a kind of a dead region coming off the bottom here, but it's very slight. So what you can basically see is that this technique allows you to view the propagating acoustic field. So if we keep going, the problem with low frequencies, as we go lower in frequency, is that if you imagine you're kind of integrating over a three-dimensional field, and when you have directivity out the front of the speaker that's really strong and not out the sides, it means that your effect is dominated by anything perpendicular. So what we're seeing at the moment is pretty much a crossover of the a cross-section of the field. But as we go lower and lower in frequency, it starts to hit its limitations, at least in the chamber that we have. So any anechoic chamber is only anechoic down to a certain frequency, and at certain low frequencies you need a really kind of much bigger wedges than we have in our anechoic chambers. So between each of those measurement points, if you imagine you're scanning a laser point across, you need to leave a longer period for your room to die in between. Otherwise, by the time you move to the next measurement point, the room's still ringing. And at low frequencies, that can cause a problem. So it's also a big problem when your retroreflective material isn't stiff, because you'll start to move your material, and for your next measurement point, it will still be flapping. So one thing you can draw from this is in the far field, these scans are all pretty good. I may have done this in the wrong order, so kind of bear this in mind. I'm going to go back to this for the moment. Okay, right, so here's another example of high frequencies. So what we have here is two examples of two speakers radiating at high frequency. So we can basically compare those speakers. In this view, there isn't so much that you can do in direct comparison, but what we can do, which hasn't been done here, is take RMSs of the scans and look at the intensity, so that we can move towards something you'd much more expect for kind of directivity plots. Unfortunately, it's not coming out so well on the projector, but there is diffraction occurring around the top edge of the speaker. And that's, you know, it's proven to be quite a useful tool for that. You'll notice that kind of the remnants of the scan, so the general kind of flowing in the scan, that's as a result of not leaving enough time in between the scans. Go ahead.
Pointing things at the cabinet.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. See, you know, when you spend all your time looking at data, you learn what to ignore. The thing is, just ignore this. okay. So what it is basically where we couldn't scan the field. There's missing scan points, and as a result, when we mesh the data and we convert that into a surface, it likes to think that there's a diagonal in between there. Thanks for pointing that out. It's not clear. Okay, so we have a speaker of here with a curved top. You can just see that out.
So what I'm seeing just before the sweep is the reflected sound coming back.
Yeah, so this it's in the hemianechoic chamber, and we're running this at 30 hertz. So the time in which the sound takes to reach the walls is about 15 milliseconds. And we're basically before it hits the walls.
There.
Yeah. So that's a remnant of the last scan. So if we want to do a higher resolution and cleaner scan, we basically just need to increase the sample length, just to leave it to die, or just, you know, reduce the rep rate of the generator. So this technique, it can be used for anything that we can latch onto a trigger source. So as long as so in this case, what we have is an internal generator with an output sink, and the measurement will kind of wait for the next trigger, you kind of as you would expect. Go ahead.
Good question. You suddenly get these white to black brown. Do you set an arbitrary level above and below which you get a colour change?
Okay, so for these scans, I'll be honest, we're doing it qualitatively. We haven't looked in detail at the relationship between what the vibrometer thinks is velocity and what is actually pressure. And that's definitely something that we will be looking at. We're planning on presenting this work in a paper, so it's one of the things that, being NPL, kind of, you know, will be leaned on to get some sort of, not traceability, but backing up of our results. So we'll be looking at comparisons between acoustic measurements and these measurements.
What's the nature of the noise in the image?
Okay, so the noise in the image is caused by, it's an optical process, so it can depend on the quality of the retroreflective material behind. And by nature of the laser focuses onto a very small point to maximise signal-to-noise ratio. And as a result, you have to have really good homogeneity in the reflective properties of your retroreflector. In the case of using street sign material, it's worse than this. This is using, it's kind of, you know, dense material. They use them for backing material. It used to be green screen, but now it's retroreflective material with LEDs around the camera. So you can basically project any light that you wish. So you want a red screen, you have a green screen or whatever, so the light always comes back to the camera. It's quite clever. I'm not sure if that's fully adopted everywhere, because when you've got multi-camera approaches, I don't quite know how it would work. So you can reduce the amount of noise. One way you can do that is something that's called speckle tracking, which is built into the vibrometer software. So it moves the laser pointer discreetly around the point that you're scanning, and that obviously is obviously only activated when you're averaging. So when you have 30 averages, you get these discrete movements, and it kind of sums. Okay, so here's an example of edge diffraction. So there's a rounded cabinet with a sweep radiation from the tweeter. In reality, it's actually slightly further up the speaker. The speaker comes down a bit further. And what you can do, obviously, is you can whack up the contrast when you're outputting the data, and you can get an impression of the lower intensity regions. Okay, and here's a comparison of a rounded edge cabinet. Unfortunately, I couldn't put these on the same slide. They're slightly too large to be played side by side. They tend to stutter. But you get an idea of the directivity here. So you notice that the colour variation directly in front. So this speaker is facing upwards on its back. And you can see you've got kind of narrowing of the beam. And that's the end. So at the end, you get an impulse. Now this at the end, I left this in because it's an explanation of why you need time gating when you're using a flexible backing material. So that first part is the acoustic field, and that second part is that acoustic field hitting the backing material and moving the backing material. So it gives you an idea of how sensitive the setup is. It could also be an effect of the pressure doubling that you get when you hit a solid surface or a boundary. So whatever it is, it's a problem. So we have to time gate the scans to gate out that effect.
So your sweep's about 8 milliseconds.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So about 8 milliseconds. In this case, the speaker is slightly closer to the edge of the room than before. Okay, and here's a square cabinet. So seeing them side by side, which we can't at the moment, you do see slightly more kind of being diffracted around the sides, as you would expect. One thing that I will... this is all worth saying, that this work that we're doing with PMC is work in progress, and we'll be putting out kind of polished... kind of better results in a paper kind of later in the year at some point. So what we can do with that kind of thing is what I intend to do at least is to output an impulse, because I think it would be really interesting to put out a really short impulse to see it radiating along the front of the cabinet and away from the edge. And one of the important factors to think about here is that obviously when in terms of acoustic sampling, you have the Nyquist frequency, and you don't, you know, arguably, you don't really need to go too much higher than the Nyquist. But in this case, because we're looking at the motion of waves, it's actually quite useful to go way above the Nyquist. And the vibrometer that we have can go up to 20 megahertz. So that means that if we want to look at really slow images, we can look at, you know, 20 mega frames per second if we wanted to. It's not quite as impressive as doing it with a camera, because you have to do it in series rather than taking all of the data at once. So in reality, capturing a scan like that might take you kind of 40 minutes, anywhere from 40 minutes up to a couple of hours. Okay, so this is work in progress again, but what we've managed to do is try to overcome the fact that we're scanning in two dimensions through a three-dimensional field. So if you take your speaker and put it on a turntable in the middle of your room and scan a two-dimensional area above the speaker and rotate your speaker at 1 degree steps, or it can be slightly more, but you lose kind of the resolution. And then you put it through computer tomography regimes that are used, the type of thing that you get in medical imaging systems, you can recreate the three-dimensional field. It's given this as an experimental technique, one that we're still working on, it's limited massively by memory usage on computers. You know, we actually run this on a computer with 96 gig of RAM and 16 cores because we don't have optimized code. You know, in the medical world, everything's optimized and honed. We're kind of writing it in MATLAB. So it could be a lot better. Now, this kind of resolutions, you know, this is a very low resolution. I should explain here what we have. So three-dimensional field, and these are slices. So that's an XY slice. So it's a slice along there, ZY, so losing my orientation, and then ZX there. So it gives you an idea that you can actually pull out real two-dimensional slice information, and that's going to be something that we're pushing slightly more into, the options for that. I have a close-up of the... sorry, it's running so slow. You don't really get a feel for it when it's jittering. Okay. Well, that might be something you have to look out for when we start publishing this data. Okay, so getting on to other applications for this. It's not limited to acoustic sources. It's limited to anything that has an acoustic interaction. And one of the things that I was really keen to look at are quadratic residue diffusers, because obviously they're quite complex. You get a lot of people that build them and don't quite understand how they work, but the science behind them is sound. So I was quite interested. There's a couple of examples around the back there. The one that we used is a QRD 734. You see graphs like this, and you look at the diffusion coefficients, and you think, I'm not entirely sure what that means. You know, it's not the most intuitive kind of display of a diffusion characteristic of a board. So this is what I really hoped. I was really hoping that we'd get some nice results off this. So here is an example with a flat board and a diffuser on the right. So it'll loop several times. So the flat board, typical kind of reflecting surface, gives you a very strong reflection. And the diffuser, unfortunately the diffuser has wooden edges along the top and bottom, so we can't scan down the wells. But that is something that I would like to do. So it's not a fantastic impulse, but it's not bad. Obviously, one of the problems in this case is creating an impulse that can be triggered 2,000 times, 10,000 times. Obviously, if we're doing it in parallel, we can use a starting pistol or something that's a bit more explosive. But in this case, we have to use loudspeakers. So again, you see some remnants in the room as a result of it being a scan that's slightly too quick. Okay, so here's a comparison with, so firstly on the top right-hand corner, just a different colouring regime. So obviously, because this is just numbers really, we can just colour it however we want. Gives you slightly a better impression of where the high and low pressures are. You might guess that the blue is low pressure and the red is high pressure. So what we have here is a finite difference time domain approximation of the properties. This wasn't done by us, this was done by Trevor Cox and the guys at Salford. They weren't entirely sure how accurate this was, and I think you can see, even though we have a different design of diffuser, you can see that there are some great similarities and I think great promise. So I think what we may do is push forward with either bouncing some impulses off these or looking at modelling some of those. I think that's more likely, just getting some in and seeing what we can do with them than actually spending time kind of getting the modelling sorted out.
Am I correctly interpreting that it's not a positive leading phase impulse?
Yeah.
It's a negative phase.
Yeah, so it's not something that I've looked into exactly why that is. The generator might be inverting, or at least so the generator when I had this on this setting.
Is it interesting to see the difference?
Yeah, true. Obviously, in this case, we have a very harsh positive impulse. So I think the closer we can get, the better. It would be something good to look at. Okay, and here's just an example of just the standard setup. So some of the details lost here, unfortunately, but just the projector. But so we have a speaker on the right and a diffuser on the left, and this just gives you an idea of the viewing window that we can achieve. So with classical Schlieren techniques, we'd be limited to something, you know, about this big, because that's the size of your collimating lens. But in this case, we can actually scan non-parallelly through the field. And if we did want to correct for the fact that we're going through a three-dimensional field, we could redo this and scan in three dimensions and use the computer tomography techniques, which is something I really wanted to do for today, but the measurements didn't work out. It's definitely possible. It's just more of a case of kind of data management at this case, because you've got, you know, so many samples per point and 360 times 20,000 data points times the number of samples. You imagine it's quite a large matrix. Okay, so this is a slightly clearer example of why we're time gating. So if you wait for it, I was cropping the other video, but... So the intensity of when the wave actually hits the flexible backing is far greater than the acoustic field. So if you were to try this, just be wary of that, because you might think that you're looking at your acoustic field, but you're actually looking at the wave hitting the backboard. If you have a stiff backing, it doesn't seem to be so much of an issue, which kind of indicates that it's more of a flexibility issue rather than the pressure doubling. But what's quite neat, there may be applications for it, is the fact that you can actually see the creases in the material when the wave hits it. So it's effectively kind of sonar. You're looking at the time delay of the sound hitting all those surfaces. Okay, so this is our hemianechoic chamber. So one of the questions that we get when we give tours in our chambers, and you can probably imagine we have to give a lot of tours to a lot of random people. One of the questions that people ask is, why are your wedges, or why is the absorption on the walls triangular? So, you know, it's an interesting question. Sometimes we get it wrong, but mostly, you know, we say it's because this, you know, the sound, it increases the surface area, these absorbers aren't so absorbent, you know, it's not perfect. But I just think, I just did a study and I just thought this is such an elegant, just, you might as well show it. So we've got same material, two different designs, wedges and a flat face. And you can see, you get some trailing reflection as you come in. There's nothing that comes out. I mean, there will be something obviously that comes out, but we have these on the same scale. So just to give you an idea of the comparative level that comes back. One thing to bear in mind is something I really want to try is taking this technique into a real world application. You know, just thinking how neat it would be to be able to scan the diffusers in the Royal Albert Hall or something like that. You know, as long as you can kind of time gate out reflections, then it's possible. Obviously, in a reverberant environment like that, you need to give a bit more time to let the measurements decay. But it could be an overnight scan. It could be something like that. Okay, so I don't know how I'm doing for time. I think I might have gone slightly quick, but I just thought I'd show you some. Given it's called visible sound, and in reality, sound isn't really visible. You know, none of those intensities that we were looking at there. So most of those scans were at most about 95 decibels, so not very high in intensity. But what happens when you crank it up a bit and you go higher in frequency and you do it in water? So this is what you'd think of. You talk about ultrasound, you talk about imaging with ultrasound. This isn't what I'm going to be talking about. So this is basically using sound to convert into a computer model and get an image of the reflections off a solid object or an interface. So in ultrasound, one big area of work that I and some of the guys on the back left over there working, three guys at the end also work in my department, is high intensity focused ultrasound. Okay, so you might not appreciate it, but if you turn the intensity up of ultrasound hard enough and focus the intensity down, you can cook tissue. And it basically, because sound travels very well into the body through water because it's a nice impedance match, you can focus to very small areas to create high intensity heating. And it's being used for cancer applications, especially in things like prostate cancer, which is kind of growing in popularity because current techniques are pretty unpleasant. So this up there is a high intensity focused ultrasound transducer, or HIFU transducer. And this, you know, is a typical way that you'd scan the sound field of it, much like you would with a loudspeaker. You place a microphone around it and however many dimensions, and you build up an image of it. So we have a needle hydrophone there. So it's got a very small active element on the end. And this is on a 10-axis scanning tank, so it can move both sources and change alignment and all that kind of stuff. So obviously it takes quite a while. And the other thing to factor in these kind of applications, whether you're scanning a microphone or a hydrophone, your testing device will perturb the field. You know, it's a really important thing to think about. You have to kind of correct for the perturbations of some testing microphones because of their casing design. So with high intensity focused ultrasound, in the focus, which can be about the size of a grain of rice, we have intensities, or we have peak pressure values of about 20 megapascals. So 120 decibels in air. This isn't such a good comparison, but just to give you an idea, 120 decibels in air is 20 pascals peak. In the water, we're going to 20 megapascals peak, and intensities of many, many watts per centimetre squared. So you get a lot of heating in a very small area. So what happens to the acousto-optic effect in that case? So the light is visibly bent. So that's a pattern set behind a high-free transducer that's on. On the left it's off, and then on it's on the right. So yeah, so 1200 watts per centimeter squared. So it's quite a lot of energy. And you can see that it makes a visible effect. So this is visible sound. Okay. So there's a close up. It's underwater and it's out of our hearing range, but it's still visible sound. Or visible acoustic waves. Okay, so just to give you an idea, here's kind of the Schlieren effect in its kind of most basic. So we're scanning a laser point through a field, through a field that's off, and looking at the point on a screen behind. So when you turn the transducer on, what happens is, because it's a propagating acoustic wave, the light gets bent in maximas in a certain direction and minimas a different direction. Because that's happening at, in this case, this transducer is radiating at 1 megahertz. Okay, so the laser will be streaked. Oddly enough, that's the German term for Schlieren, is to streak. I think I've got that correct. Correct me if I'm wrong. So here is a laser point with an increasing intensity field. So we're at 70 watts per centimetre squared. Here's what it's at 1.5 megapascals, 8 megapascals. And you'll see that the laser is starting to be blurred or streaked, 15 megapascals. And you'll notice that it's just an interesting fact, that the laser's being blurred in one direction more than the other. It's because water it's a non-linear medium when you're compressing it with those kind of amplitudes. So it kind of goes one way or the other, much more than it does the other. Okay, so we didn't use a laser vibrometer for this application. We used a bit of paper with some lines on it and a webcam. Because it's such an apparent effect, you don't need the kind of specialities of vibrometers. And that's the kind of image that you can get. So just using the webcam. And if you get the right kind of spacing of your lines, well, a really good line configuration is actually rainbows, or colour bands, because your eyes perceive this blurring of the colour bands to a changing colour. It kind of goes towards grey. If you're kind of close enough so you can distinguish the different colours, then it becomes very apparent. And the other thing is that if you're orientated like this, looking at a field with a backing, say, that far behind through a tank, the stereoscopic nature of the field really becomes quite apparent, and you see it here with the backing over there, and it's quite a nice thing. You get a real sense of the three-dimensional nature of the field, even though it's kind of a three-dimensional a through projection. So it's like having a fluid within water of a different viscosity, but seeing kind of transparent. This video isn't going to load. Yes. Okay, I have those. I'm going to get them. Bear with me. Okay, so again, just using a webcam, we stuck a knife in the field. So this is real time. So you can see the kind of reflections off the field. So if you ever wanted to go into ultrasound, you can do stuff like this. So, here's an example of a transducer being swept. So our high-free transducers are very high Q, so they have a very defined frequency. Singular frequency, and this is going from 1.3 to down to 1 megahertz. So you can see that the intensity really kind of goes through the roof, around 1.07 megahertz, if I remember correctly. One of the problems here is that you're kind of your detail gets compressed, because once you start blurring that image over a certain distance, then it kind of all just becomes grey. Okay, and here's another one going even further from the topic that I was down for. Okay, so light from bubbles. So you may know about cavitation. Okay, so this is another area that I work in. So off the back of propellers on boats, the pressure being built up on the front surface, or the front surface of the propeller, is much greater than that on the back. And when that occurs, you get a shocking of the water, and the water is pulled apart to create vacuous bubbles. They have a bit of vapor inside them, but they're mostly vacuous, and they can be very damaging. What they do is, when they get near any surface, so if you imagine a vacuous bubble, so it would like to collapse, but if it's anywhere near a static surface, then the bubble will collapse inwards, but this water here can't be pulled in, and that water can be pulled in quite easily, so the bubble ends up collapsing in like a torus. And what you get through the back of the bubble is a water jet that gets pulled towards the surface, and that can travel at, you know, kind of Mach 1 or whatever, but it's a very small jet. We're talking kind of tens of microns across, but it's traveling very quickly, and that can do this to hardened steel. So over time, those minuscule bubbles can eat away at steel, and it's a big problem. There's not much you can do about it. You just have to design the pressure flow around your propeller to be better so that you don't get cavitation. Okay, so you can also create cavitation using ultrasound. So pressure variations, when they're really high intensity, like kind of like the HIFU, but maybe not so high as the focus, you basically, the pressure variations cause anything in the water, kind of, you know, the propagation of sound. But if you go below a certain point, the vaporization point of the water, you can pull the water apart and create these cavities that are unstable, and they will collapse and they will oscillate in the field. And under the right conditions, when the bubbles collapse, if they collapse nice and evenly, the pressure goes through the roof, the temperature then therefore goes through the roof, and you get light emitted. Okay, so might sound odd, but if you have the right resonant cavity, you can get single bubbles emitting light. There was a big excitement several years ago because people weren't quite sure what the mechanism was for the light emissions, and they were thinking whether we were getting fusion. You know, imagine in a tank full of cold water and people speculating that you've got fusion, you can imagine they got quite excited. But the mechanisms aren't fully understood. Some people think it's a recombination of RH radicals when the vapors formed from the cavities when the water's pulled apart. Okay, so but this is what you can get. So if I go back, there's the reference vessel. We're looking at standardization of cavitation, and this is our reference vessel. So we have transducers all the way around. It's filled with water, and it radiates at fixed frequency into the vessel to create a known mode shape. And then we put cavitation sensors in there. And then you get this kind of thing. So that's this has been doped with luminol, the stuff that you find in glow sticks. It accentuates the what's called sonoluminescence. So it's technically sonochemiluminescence, so it's chemically doped. So there's, I think this is about 20 kilohertz, and that's 140 kilohertz. So you can see at 140 kilohertz, you've got a fantastic focus. And then you've got some kind of motion down the sides because of the modes of the vessel. So that's kind of roughly it. I wanted to show you all that because for us, kind of acoustics does really span across the three areas. You know, it's the same equation, it's just different mediums, different speeds of sounds and all that kind of stuff. So thank you for listening.
Trying to end up with a quantifiable unit for quality of sound. at all, or are you, is that sort of...
Okay, so one of the areas that I didn't present here, partially because we've got some presentations coming up, is in the a new technique for deriving the standard for sound. So at the moment, we don't have a standard microphone that is calibrated and then we get the decibel from that. What we have is... we have a technique, so it's traceable to a technique that's reliant upon three microphones and the fact that testing microphones are can be driven reciprocally, so they can be driven as well as receive. So using reciprocity is quite an established technique. We can calibrate off each other, but as a result, there's uncertainties there that we don't like. So in a very similar setup, but it's not using the acousto-optic effect, we're looking at ways to get pressure measurements in a free field. What you do is you split off the laser and cross it over within a certain area, and you look at the diffraction pattern as a result. And that diffraction pattern is proportional to the nature of that diffraction pattern is proportional to the localized pressure. So we're kind of doing the whole kind of looking towards kind of getting a measurement, a singular kind of non-destructive, non-perturbing measurement. This is more of a qualitative thing, and it's something that I was quite keen to present it to the AES, and thanks for asking me, because I just think it's something that is there for speaker manufacturers and acoustic designers, because it just needs a retroreflective board. You need a laser vibrometer as well. Okay. So if you have one of those already, or you can get access to one. So a scanning one, I'm sure you get a more accurate figure out the back, but I think our one was kind of close to about 100 grand. But it's a very, very useful bit of kit. And it's not just for this, for the scanning of modal breakup of speakers and all that kind of stuff. And it's very established for that application. So you get much lower uncertainty than I've kind of been showing with the acousto-optic technique.
Could I ask one very stupid question?
Okay.
What's a MEMS microphone?
Okay, MEMS. Sorry, micro-electromechanical systems. So it's basically on chip. So instead of being kind of a silicone and instead of being that, it's actually kind of a diaphragm on chip. If you look at it under a microphone, it's capacitive plates, but it's just done on a very small scale. And the issue that we're coming across is that they've been designed for mobile phones. They've been designed for speech band and maybe slightly higher. So their phase response and frequency response really drops off, because you might have seen from that picture it's a resonant cavity. It's not a flat membrane in a free field. It's actually a resonant cavity, so that kind of plays into it. But we don't want to turn around to the people who manufacture these things and say, no, you want to design a high spec version of what you're doing, because they won't make any money from it. So we're kind of looking more into techniques to adapt current technologies to kind of improve frequency responses, because the reality is that they're not going to sell the numbers of testing grade versions of those microphones as they will for others.
What do you use the reverb chamber for?
Reverb chamber, okay, so typically we use it for microphone calibrations, so you can excite the room with white noise typically is a white noise in there, and you can, within a certain frequency range, you can assume that you have a diffuse field. At low frequencies you get modal behaviours in the room, even though the room has five walls and none of them are parallel, including the ceiling. You do get modal behaviour. Another one is absorption measurements. So you set off an impulsive sound or excite it with white noise and then stop it and listen to the decay time as a function of frequency. And then you put your objects in there, and you can, from that, deduce using the Sabine and Ehring equations, the absorption coefficients as a function of frequency. So that things like acoustic ceiling tiles, wedges, whatever, they pretty much would have been tested in one of those, if not an impedance tube. Because an impedance tube, so a plane wave duct, gives you a plane wave measurement of absorption. That gives you a diffuse measurement of absorption. So it kind of takes into account the shape of an object as well.
If you were to take a fly's wing and attach it to the ceiling via a spider's thread, and then put one of your retro-reflective crystals on it, and fire the laser vibrometer at it, what sort of second anniversary show would you get?
Well, retroreflective dots have been used in vibrometry applications where the signal-to-noise ratio isn't significant. So you can get these kind of little sticky dots that you can put and you can align your laser to it. So if you can't get enough light reflected off the wing without the retroreflective material, then you would get a good signal-to-noise ratio, but assuming it's the type of retroreflectors that we get, if you're looking for the vibration of the wing, yeah, you can do it. But if you want to listen to the sound propagating from that, so if you're scanning just past it and listening with a retroreflector, unlikely.
I want the vibration of the wing to act as a microphone.
Oh, I see. Vibration of the wing to act as a microphone.
Full frequency range all the way down to DC. But
Well, assuming you have a light enough material, something that was actually looked at before we did any of this, not by us, is the use of really thin veils. So I think it's a shame because whoever was doing it was really close because they were basically using a scanning laser vibrometer to scan a thin veil on axis with a speaker. All they needed to do was put a retroreflector on the other side and take the veil away. But the veils do move enough, but obviously you have inertial behaviours of the veils and the wings, and the wing will have a frequency response and all that kind of stuff. It's not quite what you're asking, but the sensitivity of the system isn't as high as we'd like it to be. We have to drive the speakers above 80 decibels. Ideally, we'd like it to be lower. You can, an interesting thing you can do is if you're scanning the vibrometer across a room and you have a really good reflector, like a mirror on the other side, you can talk into the laser line and you can hear it come out of the monitor in the control room. And that's just the acousto-optic effect. But we're pretty good at kind of distinguishing at getting signals out of noise. If you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, it's pretty horrific. But it's kind of an optical effect, so you want as much light to come back as possible.
Could I say, if the surface is responding to the sound, then if you're getting a signal back from the laser vibrometer, it would detect those sort of micro nano vibrations.
Exactly. I mean, in the case of the flexible backing material, you did see that the amplitude of that variation was far greater than the acousto-optic effect. So, if you want to do it, you just talk to me afterwards. Go ahead.
Last time I was down at MPL some years ago, acoustic measurements or sound measurements were still traceable back to the Raleigh disk with its infinite numbers of correction equations and everything. Do you still maintain that as a root standard?
I think the easiest way to answer that is that I haven't heard of that. So I assume it's not. It's something, I think pretty much reciprocity has taken over as a technique. It's It's quite an elegant technique, but it has its limitations. At the moment, we are limited by frequency. We can only go up to about 50 kilohertz. Obviously, that's fine for most audio applications, but in reality, some microphones and transducers go way up because it's kind of reliant on a resonant cavity. So you put all of the microphones into this cavity, and you have to assume that it's a pressure field, so it's not diffuse and it's kind of homogeneous.
Do you ever use Gerlach's electrostatic actuation technique?
I'm not familiar with that either.
This was done at Siemens in the 1920s, where you have a grid in front of a condenser microphone diaphragm, and you apply potential to that to drive the diaphragm.
Ah, yeah.
And then you can measure the sound field by adjusting the phase and strengthening the potential to bring the diaphragm to rest.
Mm.
After this, you can calculate the pressure.
It's not something I'm aware that we've done, but it really does ring a bell. I think we discussed it for something, but it's not quite. I don't think it's something we adopt, but it may be. I'm more than happy to find out and let you know. So.
Thanks for your talk. So I may be slightly misunderstanding this, and you may have answered the question by saying that that was quite weak. But you also mentioned wanting to do it with a starting pistol, having a really genuinely big impulse going.
Mm.
What happens if you start going through, you know, more than 2 pi phase shifts in your field? Or is that okay? I mean, are you going to get problems with phase wrapping essentially? And that's especially a problem if you do fire an impulse at something you've got
Different frequencies. Okay, so at the most sensitive setting that the vibrometer goes at, that would become an issue. But the vibrometer is designed for a wide range of Doppler shifts, and it can cope with that. You just have to go down. So it's most sensitive that we have. We're getting it upgraded actually, so we don't have the most sensitive equipment. But ours is at 10 millimeters per second in terms of an acceleration sensitivity. Obviously, that doesn't really correlate to acoustic pressure, but the clever people at Polytech have kind of worked out how to scale it and change the sensitivity of the phase lock loop, because it's based on a phase lock loop, and at least from what I understand, you can kind of adopt methods so that you can go over larger frequency ranges. So that's not really answering your question, but there's something along those lines.
Anything else?
I understand the police were able to listen to conversations by looking at the windows. They've got a device. Is it a cheap version, or did they use a grand version?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, good question. I assume a significant amount of the cost in our vibrometer is the fact that it scans. You can get vibrometers that are much more low tech and kind of tuned to a certain frequency range. There's talk of creating MEMS. They're kind of interferometers, to give them a kind of proper term. And there's talk of creating kind of MEMS interferometers. So for the police, it could be an application, but the problem is you need really good signal to noise ratio. So you need a lot of light coming back, which means that you need either a good retroreflector or a really nicely aligned mirror. And the biggest problem in that application is because we're right down at the sensitivity of the variations of pressure in the air, wind completely destroys your measurement. The turbulent noise that you get from wind. Obviously, you can kind of high pass filter it, but you will still get misalignments because of variations in the alignment of the laser and all those kind of things. It's quite a complex problem.
Ian, can I just say,
go ahead.
We do have a new laser vibrometer that has 100 meter range capability.
Really?
So if you have a little green spot pointing at you,
oh, fantastic. Yeah, one of the things with the vibrometer is that it's a defocused laser. So it comes out about this large, and you focus it down to a point, to maximise the signal-to-noise ratio of any light coming back. So,
and I'd also say why you wouldn't worry about measuring the window, you just go through the window and measure a calendar or something.
Yeah, because one of the big benefits of it is that you can gate. You know, you can kind of look in the time domain and look at different aspects of the signal. There's some really impressive stuff happening with lasers and acoustics. I heard about another company that has built a... it's basically a fibre optic sensor. It fires a laser down the fibre optic and it can listen to any point along the line of the fibre optic at anything like... I think it's like... Yeah, so it's quite an impressive thing, and it basically uses optical time gating, from what I understand.
So watch out for spies carrying Ripper.
Maybe.
Well, there is an immediate application for that, which is to stop thefts of cabling for signals on railways and
fence and stanchions. Yeah, that's very true, actually. The immediate application I think they have is is for underwater applications, listening to propagation away from piling noise and that kind of thing when they're building offshore wind farms. So when offshore wind farms are being built, they need to be piled into the solid rock, and sound travels at 1,500 metres per second in water. So that means that you don't get very much absorption and it goes pretty far. So if you're whacking a pile into solid rock, you could be messing up a whale's migration pattern, you know, 100 kilometres away, if not more. So it's quite a big problem, and to be honest, a lot of our underwater work is in that area. Yeah, looking at kind of distributed listening to the ocean and that kind of stuff.
Any more?
I'm not sure if this is specialised for you,
Robert,
but Polytech.
Okay.
Is there any work towards having more than one laser beam focused at different places at the same time? If you have, I'm just thinking along the lines of a digital camera or a camera, with a bit of sensors inside the interferometer, would you be able to measure, instead of scanning, actually read two or more points at the same time? So
you have to have two laser micrometers.
Right.
There is an interesting sensor called a Shack-Hartmann sensor. It's not an interferometer, but what it does is you create a singular light source, like a bright LED, and it uses a CCD, a camera CCD, and in front of the CCD, instead of there being one lens, it has an array of lenses, so 100 by 100 lenses, and you capture the image and the computer analyzes it. So it looks at the drift of the dot of that laser point on the CCD as a function of area. So you know that the volume that light has come through, you can work out how far it's been shifted. So it's kind of, we were doing some work on it and then we worked out this webcam technique. So you imagine how expensive it would be to make something with 100 lenses by 100 lenses. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Ian. And we'll see you all next time.